So with that, I understand we're allocating time in this case, and my understanding is that Mr. Ned, you'll be arguing first, and that you've allocated 30 minutes to that argument. Is that correct?
Your Honor, we were asking that I have 10 minutes of rebuttal.
Okay, I'll allow you 10 minutes of rebuttal. So if you're ready, come on up.
Good morning. I'm Daryl Ned. I'm a senior deputy Nevada attorney for injured workers. I'm here with Evan Beavers, who is the Nevada attorney for injured workers. Our client is Vincent Jerome. Vincent Jerome has made a career out of law enforcement. In September, relative to this case, he's been employed both by RTA as well as Lyon County. And for each of these employers, he's worked more than five consecutive years. In March 2011, while employed by RTA, he suffered a heart attack while on vacation in Mississippi. The compensability of Mr. Jerome's heart disease has never been in dispute. And that's because his heart attack qualifies as heart disease under NRS 617-457 and the fact that he's been employed by Lyon County, which clearly fits the definition of a police officer under 617-135, subsection 1. The dispute that's existed here has been created by Lyon County when it's asserted the last injurious exposure rule as an affirmative defense and argue that RTA officers qualify as police officers, and thus RTA should be liable for Mr. Drone's compensable heart disease.
Now, that's my question. Was he classified as a police officer or security? Does it make any difference?
I believe it's a police officer is how RTA has listed it.
Okay.
The licensure's exposure rule itself was adopted by this court in 1985 in the Jesch case. And the purpose of adopting the case was to ensure compensability of industrial conditions when multiple employers are involved. As you can see by these proceedings, that has evolved really into being just a defense where you have an employer who tries to shift liability onto another employer. Now, Nevada, at a minimum, in terms of procedural due process, requires notice and an opportunity to be heard. So whenever you're going to have a last injurious exposure defense, you're going to have that other employer present for the purposes of that litigation. There's no dispute that appeals officers have the authority to join a party. You see that in the Dutchess case where this court had indicated, although NRCP 19 and 20 don't apply to administrative proceedings, the court recognized that an administrative agency does have the discretion to join parties. Additionally, if you look at NRS 616D050, subsections D, F, and I, you'll see that the appeals officer has powers ranging from calling and examining witnesses and parties to a claim, as well as addressing any type of legal issues that arise in a proceeding and addressing procedural issues. The question really for this court and what's really happening in this case is that the appeals officers, although they have the authority, lack the precise procedural mechanism to bring in another employer. And that's what you can see in the record below. You actually have a dialogue at the September 23, 2011 proceedings between Lyon County's counsel and the appeals officer trying to figure out how do we get RTA into these proceedings. Both discuss the fact that, well, we've seen motions to join and we've done it that way, and both end up agreeing, well, the easiest way is just to have Mr. Jerome conscripted to bring RTA in. Now, at that time, they did not realize that there was a separate proceeding, so the suggestion was that Mr. Jerome file another claim against RTA and to bring in RTA that way.
And then let us make the record clear, my understanding is that Mr. Jerome was not represented by counsel at that time. Is that correct?
At the time of the appeals officer proceeding in September 2011, he was represented by counsel.
He was represented?
Right. At the underlying case, there's two levels. You have a hearing officer level.
I understand that.
Okay.
I wasn't sure where the counsel ultimately joined.
Right. Nevada attorney for injured worker, we were appointed on July 29, 2011. And the decision by the hearing officer, RTA, was June 29, 2011. So the time that our office met with Mr. Jerome, that time to appeal the RTA decision would have already passed. So relative to the period in time, he was not represented by counsel. And I think it's important to note the significance of that. If you look at the informality of that first level of proceeding, it's pretty large. You have Mr. Drone essentially in a room with a hearing officer. If you look at the record, Mr. Balkenbush appeared by telephone. It's not clear from the hearing officer's decision involving RTA if Mr. Rowe was there physically. It just says that he was representing RTA. But you essentially have an injured worker sitting in their one hearing office and a hearing officer having two hearings with two different parties. And obviously he's not aware that it's two separate proceedings. And you can see that when they get together on September 23rd, 2011, the parties are asking Mr. Drone, well, was RTA at the earlier proceeding? And he said, yeah, they were. But he didn't have the wherewithal to say, but that was a separate legal proceeding. And that's why no one realized that there was that separate proceeding. So it's our position that, I guess the real question for the court is, in terms of public policy, whose responsibility is it to bring in this other employer? And it's our position that it is the responsibility of the party raising the last injurious exposure defense. And they have a means of doing it. We already discussed the fact that the appeals officer has the authority to bring in another party. All that needs to happen is that the employer raising the last injurious exposure defense simply file a motion to join the other party, serve it like any other motion, and the appeals officer would be able to adjudicate whether or not this party should be joined. The reason why it's a public policy issue as it exists now is the result of the fact that the appeals officer was not sure of how to bring in RTA, Mr. Jerome's claim, which never was disputed in terms of compensability, is now non-compensable. And although the last injurious exposure rule was designed to ensure compensability by assigning liability, no liability is being assigned.
So, counsel, who would or how have other jurisdictions written a rule that would allow us to follow the interpretation that you suggest? That is, the person asserting last injurious rule as a defense should be compelled to bring in the other party.
Well, I think if you look at our, I can't cite other jurisdictions, but I can certainly refer to our approach here in Nevada. I can start off by going back to the Jetsch decision. If you look at how that case ends, it's what happens is this court says to Ms. Jess, you identify the employers and you give the names of these employers to CIS, and presumably CIS would sort out exactly which of the employers in the last injurious exposure rule would be required to do that. We have a situation here under our legal system that the employer has the ability to do depositions, discovery, such as interrogatories, requests for production. They can identify the other employers. And as I said, they have the ability just to simply file a motion to join that other party. Having Mr. Drone do it causes some complications. First of all, Nevada has a neutrality rule when it comes to workers' compensation cases.
Why do they care? If they're going to get off the hook at the appellate level, why would they care? And you're suggesting that it would not be a mandatory rule. It would instead be within their wheelhouse, if you will, to determine whether or not they want to bring someone else in. You're suggesting that we write a mandatory rule. You're also acknowledging that apparently no other jurisdiction has written such a rule. How do we resolve that?
Well, first of all, the court has adopted the last injurious exposure rule, and as we see from this case, the procedural mechanism to bring in another employer is not clear to the appeals officer. So it's our position that we already have the system set up. All we have to do is assign whose responsibility is, and there would be no reason for the person who is the claimant to be bringing in these other parties. The employer, in this case, Lyon County identified RTA back in May 2011 when it denied Mr. Jerome's claim. It made no effort to bring RTA in at the first hearing. And as you see from the records, on September 23rd, 2011, when they appeared at the hearing with the appeals officer, they had made no effort, presumably not even so much as a phone call, to try to get RTA involved here. And it was really, if you look at how the appeals officer instructed Mr. Drone to do it, it was all in terms of form and practice adjoinder. If you look at Mr. Drone's request for hearing form, he specifically identifies the reason why he's appealing that RTA decision is for consolidation and joinder purposes. If you look at the record, the appeals officer instructed Mr. Drone to file an opposition to the motion to dismiss filed by RTA. This was all an effort by an appeals officer to join somebody. We're asking you to have that mandatory rule announced because of the fact that that's the purpose would be to make sure the appeals officers know how to do something correctly so that someone like Mr. Jerome does not end up without any type of benefits when the compensability of his claim has never, ever been in dispute.
Counsel, you know, as you can tell, the panel kind of struggled with this case from the get-go. We had a 2-1 decision, and now it's up in the en banc court. I know I thought about this at the time. If this were a lawsuit, it's pretty simple. If it wasn't administrative, Mr. Jerome would sue Lyon County, and they'd assert last injurious exposure, and they'd file a third-party complaint under Rule 14 against Reno Tahoe Airport Authority. So it's simple. It's easy under the NRCP. It's not so easy as Justice Sadas pointed out under our administrative procedures. So you're asking us to what to do an opinion to announce a rule on this joinder issue, and the burden on the joinder would be on, in this case, it would have been on Lyon County to file that action to bring in the airport authority.
That's correct.
And the fact that there was no appeal initially before you got into the case of the hearing officer's decision regarding the RTA, how do we deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the difficult part of this case, obviously. I mean, I think the court's precedence in terms of jurisdiction and the sinal line of cases is very clear, but this was not, as I pointed out in some of the citations about the documents, Mr. Jones genuinely was not appealing the decision by the hearing officer against RTA. He's following instructions from the appeals officer who does not know procedurally, how am I going to bring RTA in? And at the conversation that they had in September 2011, they did not know that there was other proceeding. They were just trying to say, well, let's just have him file a claim and bring these people in. So the significance of asking for that rule is to make sure that we have an efficient process.
So if we were to reverse and Mr. Jerome becomes an aggrieved party, does his time for appeal begin to run again? How do we calculate that?
Well, just to say that the way I look at it, Mr. Jerome, you can argue. Let's go back with how this court perceives an aggrieved party. If you look at how it's defined under the context of 233B, this court has said that an aggrieved party is someone who has a personal right of property adversely affected or substantially affected. In this case, Mr. Jerome, when the decision in favor of RTA was issued by the hearing officer, was entitled to benefits by Lyon County. In fact, after the reversal of Lyon County's denial, he had a compensable claim up to this court's April 2015 decision. So he technically wasn't aggrieved because he was entitled to benefits. And frankly, if you look at the police officer statute, he would certainly have a reason to agree that RTA is not part of that statute.
Thank you.
Say that again. I think I misunderstood you.
I said that if you look at the police officer statute, there would be a reason why a litigant might not think RTA would be the liable entity.
It's why? Because of the definition of the police officer?
Well, if you look at precisely, if you look at the panel's decision was based on deciding whether includes means a limitation or expansion. And if you look at, first look at the amendment process. When a legislator has amended 617.135, they've been very specific. They've either added agencies or particular types of officers. They never have given a broad definition based on equipment, certifications, powers, or authorities. They've always been very specific. And I think the reason why that purpose, why they are being so specific, is in a sense a little bit of a notice. If you look at this statute as being expansive, okay, that's not an exhaustive list until somebody gets added, you do have an unreasonable and absurd result. What you have here, and I say it because the statute gives two benefits, the heart disease statute. The police officer is going to have the presumption. The employer is going to have him or her being compelled to take physical exams. If you look at subsection 10 of that heart disease statute, the results of those physical examinations can be used to nullify the presumption that the police officer has. So you're going to have one of two results if you expand it through the court. You're going to have either police officers get benefits that they never had to take a physical exam to get, or you're going to have employers say, well, you don't get those benefits because you never took a physical exam. And if it's important to note, if you look at RTA's answering brief, they've already made that position. They've already said, well, if RTA is covered under this statute, Mr. Drone should not be getting any benefits from us because he never took the physical exam.
So you're really arguing we should go back all the way and say the interpretation of the statute as to RTA is wrong?
I would say that's a fair position based on what kind of result you're going to have. Generally speaking, in this state, decisions by courts are applied retroactively. So you're going to have people who have never taken a physical exam put in for these benefits, and then you're going to have RTA or other employees say, wait a minute, you never took the physical exam. We're going to deny the claim. And this court will be back trying to address that issue. Well, what happens if they didn't take the physical exam because...
And it's possible that the procedural confusion is due in part to the new minted reading of that statute.
Well, I think that's exactly it.
Yeah.
I think the statute is meant to be amended, and that's why, as RTA has pointed out, it's been amended, I think, 12 times. I think that involves the legislative process, whether you want to call it horse trading or what, but there's something going on that all of a sudden you got somebody saying, well, we need to add the DMV, or we need to add this agency, we need to add that agency.
Right, but again, this particular agency wasn't added to that statute.
Yeah, and I don't think... Sorry, go ahead, Justice.
No, go ahead.
And I think that's an indication that it's not supposed to be part of the statute.
But if that piece of the decision holds, your client, nonetheless, you maintain, should prevail because the party who invoked last injurious exposure rule did not see to it that the claims against the party to whom it would shift liability was included.
Yes, Justice Pickering. It's our position.
You've got an if A, then B kind of a...
It's our position, irrespective of if the court finds RTA to be part of the statute, Mr. Jerome's claim should, a compensability of his heart disease should be restored by this court, because you have basically an effort to join RTA, so if you find RTA is part of that statute...
By what legal, what are the analytics that allow us to do that, assuming we stay with the statutory interpretation that lets this claim go against RTTA? How do you deal with procedurally what happened here?
Well, the only obstacle would be NRS 616345. And if you don't look at this as Mr. Jerome genuinely appealing the decision against RTA, but simply following the appeals officer's instructions, he didn't appeal it. This was an effort to join it. If this would be no different than if Lyon County did its duty and actually did a motion to join and RTA appeared.
Yeah.
Well, that's basically my summation. I have some time for rebuttal, so unless the court has any other questions.
Colleagues? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I understand that we're splitting up time here on the other side, and next, Mr. Balkenbush, I understand you're going to take 15 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct. Good morning, Justices, Robert Balkenbush. I represent Lyon County and the Public Agency Compensation Trust in this case. From the perspective of Lyon County and PACT, the outcome of this case could take one of three paths. One, this court could say Jerome is a police officer and entitled to benefits from the Airport Authority and Chartis. Two, Jerome is a police officer and not entitled to benefits from the Airport Authority and Chartis. Three, this court could say Jerome is not a police officer entitled to benefits from the Airport Authority and Chartis, but a police officer for Lyon County entitled to benefits from Lyon County's path. Of those three pathways, we believe the first one is the one the court should take.
Now, tell us legally how we get there. I think it goes back to Justice Pickering's question.
That's exactly why I'm here.
Okay.
So the first path is Jerome's a police officer and entitled to benefits from the Airport Authority. The first question this court, and I could tell in the orders that this court dealt with and in the briefs, how did this case become procedurally so complex? That's really the question you need to answer. And really the answer is this. The hearing officer failed to consolidate the two cases into a single administrative proceeding and issue a single decision.
And do the rules support that interpretation that says that it is the administrative level where that consolidation needs to take place?
Right. I mean, they could have done it at the hearing officer level. They could have, and certainly they could do it at the appeal.
I know they could
level,
have.
All the time.
I mean, they could have. My question is there a rule that provides for that path to be procedurally taken?
Well, there's a statute that gives them the right to regulate the proceedings. Every case has to be decided as it presents
itself. So generally speaking, it's the discretion that they have in order to join all necessary parties.
And this case particularly, I just want to illustrate where this fundamentally this error took place. The hearing officer in this case, it was one claim for heart disease against two separate employers and two different carriers. The last injurious exposure was raised as an issue, so it should have been a single decision. The hearing officer had this case. The same hearing officer heard both cases, heard them the same day, but did not hear them together. And so if that these cases would have been consolidated into a single proceeding, which makes complete sense, there would have been a single decision. We would have lost, and we would have appealed, as you already know.
But I want to go back to my question. I guess I do mean to keep interrupting you. The fact of the matter is that that didn't happen. The appellant in this case is asking us to create a per se or a mandatory rule. We don't have that yet.
You don't need it.
We're going to rely on discretion, and we're going to end up exactly where we are in this case.
Well, what we said, and I want to argue to the court is, if that had happened, the case would have proceeded as it did. In other words, both employers came and were heard in front of the appeals officer, but we wouldn't have the thorny subject matter jurisdiction issue. That's where the error took place. And so the appeals officer, let me back up here. So then this court, ultimately, the only issue before the appeals officer would have been, is he a police officer? This court's already wrestled with that issue. The appeals officer wanted this court to wrestle with that issue. But we gave the court in our briefs two pathways to get to this result. One was, as you read the record, the appeals officer did her best to put this case in the posture that the hearing officer should have. We came into court. I did not know that there was a claim against, I tried the case. I didn't know that there was a claim against the airport authority. But the appeals officer wanted both parties in front of the court. And the hearing officer should have done that to begin with. So what she did she wanted to think about joinder. Get him in here. Somehow let's get him in here. I recommended before that happens is to file a claim. And she took that path, and it turned out he had already filed a claim. And then Mr. Beavers filed an appeal from the adverse hearing officer decision. The cases came up together. The appeals officer effectively said that RTA was joined to our case. And what we argued in our briefs was there was subject matter jurisdiction of our appeal. These are administrative proceedings. These aren't common law proceedings. It's administrative proceedings. Because there was subject matter jurisdiction of our appeal, the appeals officer could join RTA to our case, and the fact that they didn't appeal, that Mr. Duran did not appeal the hearing officer decision that was adverse to him against RTAA is irrelevant. That's one pathway. Second pathway to get to this first result, which is Duran's a police officer and entitled to benefits, is this. This court has broad discretion to avoid injustice, and we gave a legal authority to this court. That's right, the Alaska cases. And we said, effectively, you can see what happened. There was just a procedural error. Procedural rules are never used to promote injustice. This court can use its broad discretion here to rule that the hearing officer should have consolidated the two hearing officer cases and issued a single decision.
Well, why isn't the burden on your client, if you're going to insist on last injurious exposure, to see to it that the worker is not harmed by virtue of your invoking that rule? In other words, so that the liability would lie with you for the procedural error rather than opening up a sort of avoid injustice, which is inherently difficult to limit.
Well, I think the way it's been argued is that somehow is an affirmative defense that I have to prove every element. The fact of the matter is, last injurious exposure was a common law doctrine adopted by this court. What we could, the claims adjuster had this case, apparently had some information, whether it was right or wrong, had some information that Mr. Duran worked as a police officer for the airport authority and raised that issue. And certainly, Mr. Duran knew about it because he filed separate claims against one against us and one against the airport authority. But the claims adjuster recognized that. We raised it to the court. And whether it's the court that uses that authority to bring somebody in under joinder or whether it's a party that does that, the court should leave that flexible. This isn't the kind of case for a mandatory rule that the responsibility for joining somebody should be us. For example, In this case, if this court wants to follow that hearing officer decision was not timely appealed, it doesn't matter whether I brought a motion for joinder, whether Mr. Duran brought a motion for joinder, or the court sua sponte did it. The result's the same. In other
words, why would Mr. Duran bring an appeal when he won?
What's that?
Why would Mr. Duran bring an appeal from a decision in which he was awarded benefits? The hearings officer awarded him benefits.
Right.
You're suggesting that it should have been his projection that on appeal it was going to go the other way and that he should have brought everybody in at the same time. It makes greater good sense to me that the person asserting, as Justice Pickering pointed out, the person asserting the defense should be the one to pull in the other party to whom they are asserting the defense.
Right, but that whole contention is really, in this case, is irrelevant because he brought a separate case against RTAA and he lost. And then he didn't timely appeal it. So if I would have brought the motion for joinder in this case, if you adopt the rule, it's mandatory. I have to file a motion for joinder. And I file a motion for joinder. You know what happens? It fails because effectively I'm trying to get the appeals officer to assert subject matter jurisdiction over the airport authority, and that can't happen because Mr. Duran did not timely appeal the hearing officer decision. That's why that rule makes no sense.
Mr. Belvin, again, I go back to that analogy. If this were a lawsuit and you're seeking indemnity, which you would be from the airport authority, you would have to, under Rule 14, third-party them in a lawsuit, regardless of what happened with the plaintiff's claim, because you're seeking indemnity, which is the lasting injurious exposure rule, saying they're responsible. So it would have been your burden. I realize there is no such rule in workers' comp, so I get it. That's why we're all struggling here. If the rule was there, we wouldn't be here today.
Right.
So but if we're going to have to address it, like opposing counsel said, tell us why we shouldn't adopt an analogy to like this Rule 14 procedure.
Well, the Rule 14 procedure, what I would say to you is that would be my claim for indemnification if I prevailed at the time of the hearing. If I go to the hearing and it's determined that he was a police officer for the airport authority, then I would proceed for indemnification against the airport authority. This court's already found that Mr. Duran is a police officer. We intend to recoup the money we paid so far from the airport authority unless this court reverses its decision as to whether he's a police officer. So in this case, because of the procedural posture of what happened, a mandatory rule in this case does not make any sense. And what I will tell you, having practiced this for 25 years, the outcome that happened in this case, rare. Almost always the case is a person does not lose out of benefits because he didn't timely appeals. Somehow, so this case is a rarity. It's not one that warrants a mandatory rule. On the first pathway, I gave you two ways to get there. The other way this case could go is the court could say, Duran is a police officer but not entitled to benefits from the airport authority. How does that pathway go? We cited a couple cases, Kaleda and Carrier, and basically, you know what happened in this case. He didn't timely appeal the hearing officer's decision. It's a voluntary act. It's a voluntary act, and that voluntary act forecloses his right to seek benefits from the airport authority. Under that pathway, procedural rules, because he didn't appeal.
Was he an aggrieved party, though, at the time of that decision in light of this secondary decision?
I could say he's aggrieved because he thought
at the time since he's been told he's going to recover, he doesn't care who he recovers from.
Right. Bottom line is never use the point on the second pathway is if you go that way and say he is a police officer but he's not entitled to benefits from the airport authority, you're using procedural principles to essentially foreclose or promote injustice and to foreclose, but that goes right to
jurisdiction. And anytime, you know, we see a lot of cases where there's procedural irregularities, to me this goes specifically to jurisdiction. And wouldn't we end up in the same if we did it in this case? Why wouldn't we be required to do it in every other case where there's a procedural error?
You can. You could go forward and decide in this case he didn't timely appeal the case. We don't have to determine. In fact, we don't even have to determine whether he's a police officer because he didn't timely appeal.
But he didn't timely appeal because it wasn't aggrieved. I'm still really stuck right there. Why would he appeal if he wasn't aggrieved? He won. Why would I appeal that?
Well, you're asking for Mr. Duran's state of mind. What I would tell you is he thought one of these people has got to be responsible. A hearing officer told him we are. Another hearing officer said the other party was not. He made a decision not to appeal. We've made arguments as to why we think he didn't appeal. What the factual inference is that his employer told him that effectively gave him information from which a factual inference could be derived, that he did not effectively think that there was coverage from the airport authority. And we've also provided some, made an attempt to try to inform this court that it looked like there was insurance coverage for it, for this claim through the airport authority. The court didn't want to take judicial notice of that information, but the point would be, he essentially, all I'm trying to say is he made a voluntary decision. There's authority for you to say he made a decision, whatever his reason was, no subject matter jurisdiction, you don't get benefits from the airport authority. Now, the third pathway is that you're going to have to reverse the position that you took to begin with as to whether he's a police officer. And we provided a very thorough analysis of that in our reply brief. And we just want to make sure that we just briefly hit on a couple of points. One, the legislative history of an airport police officer at the Reno Airport, including the creation of the airport authority, clearly supports the conclusion this court previously made. What did Duran do at the airport? We provided to you today, it's in the appendix, a picture of Mr. Duran with everything. He had his drug-sniffing dog. He had his, in the picture, he had his gun, his taser, his cuffs. At the trial of the case, we asked him, was he expected to use those if the occurrence arose? Yes. So, we presented the statute to the court, saying that the statute uses the word includes. It's not exclusive, but it can expand, be expanded to include Mr. Duran as a police officer. We also want to make sure we point out to the court, in the Daniels case, this court found that a firefighter for Rico Bechtel was a firefighter entitled to benefits. Rico Bechtel is not a municipality. It's not a state agency. It's not even the federal government per se. Now, there's not a definition of firefighter in the Occupational Disease Act, but this court must have looked at what he did to conclude that he was a firefighter. So all we're doing in this case is saying, look at Mr. Duran and what he does for the airport authority. He is clearly a police officer. The only reason he's not in the statute is nobody has actually asked yet. For most of these amendments, I've been down there at the legislature when this thing's been expanded because I represent a client who insures this, and I think it's simply not been asked yet. But this court, I don't think, is barred from making that decision. And we think that justice in this case should lead the court away from this final pathway. Should take the first pathway, find he's a police officer, and find he's entitled to benefits from the airport authority and Chartist, and let Mr. Duran get his claim compensated and let us collect. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Rowe, I understand you're taking 15 minutes as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. Timothy Rowe on behalf of the Reno Tahoe Airport Authority. Our position in this case takes a little different perspective than either the claimant in this case or Mr. Balkenbush, and that is that the Nevada legislature has, in fact, established a specific procedure for asserting a claim against an employer and adjudicating that particular claim. There's no reason for this court to adopt a joinder procedure that the legislature hasn't seen fit to adopt, because there already is a procedure that can be followed that would have protected everybody's rights here. Under that statutory scheme, a claimant is responsible for asserting a claim against an employer. There is a specific adjudication procedure specified if that claim is denied, by which a claimant can seek adjudication of those issues. And that's all statutory. It's all explained carefully in the provisions that apply to this procedure.
You're relying on 616C345-1,
no, and as well as 616C315, which establishes the underlying procedure at the hearing officer level.
Right, but was he, I guess the core question returns to, was he aggrieved by the decision as to RT?
Absolutely, and the reason he was aggrieved is that there were two separate proceedings with two separate decisions at the hearing officer level, each of which decision gave Mr. Giron appeal rights. He was specifically advised at the bottom of the decision in bold letters, you can appeal this if you don't like the decision. And he had two completely separate proceedings. And in the proceeding involving Lyon County, Lyon County took the position from the get-go that RTAA was the last injurious exposure.
And do you think they should be entitled to do that without looking out for the claimant's rights as against the party they're asserting should be held?
Yes, and I think the reason for that is because the legislature has already said it's the claimant's burden to proceed, to file the claim with the employer, and then gives them an adjudication procedure if they don't like the result that they get.
But would you agree?
Result because Lyon County was going to pay the compensation.
Right. But he also
brings us back to whether or not he was aggrieved because he was recovering from somebody.
Well, he was aggrieved by the RTAA decision, which said you're not a police officer under the statute that applies to RTAA, and so he was clearly aggrieved, and he knew that Lyon County was taking the position that RTAA was responsible and had appealed that decision.
But I'm going to step back. The premise that you began this discussion on was that it is the claimant's responsibility to assert claims against those employers, 2, 3, 4, 5, that he believes are responsible for his benefits. Do you agree that he, Mr. Giron, in this case, did so?
Yeah, absolutely, and I don't necessarily agree with the proposition that a claimant may need to file claims against 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different
employers. Assume, let's use the facts of this case. He had two different employers against whom these benefits could be sought, and he did. He properly brought a claim.
Absolutely.
So we are acting as legal minds when we say a claimant just wants payment of benefits. Can you agree with that premise?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, in this case, the claimant, Mr. Giron, received benefits from one of the two employers who he properly sued, brought an action against. So, I'm struggling over what would cause him, let's leave the aggrieved party analysis to the side, or at least that title to the side, what would, if he's getting benefits from Lyon County, and indeed there was an adverse decision against RTAA, what would lead a claimant to believe that he needed to proceed against that other entity when all he wants in the first place is his benefits?
Because Lyon County appealed that decision, and he knew Lyon County was taking the position that they weren't responsible and that a higher court or administrative judge could reverse that decision.
So the obligation then rests upon the claimant to anticipate and join based upon the appeal taken by the party against whom he was receiving benefits.
Well, I'm not saying that's the basis for it, but that's certainly what happened in this case, and I believe that Mr. Giron should have taken the appeal against RTAA because there was the clear possibility.
Well, there's no question. We wouldn't be here if he had done so.
Right.
But I'm trying to look at it from a rule standpoint. What prompts a claimant, other than the appeal, that he maybe he's going to lose, maybe he's going to win, to suddenly know he should bring in that third party? I see it on the other side of the V in this instance.
But initially, he files the claim against both parties, presumably because he's not sure which party is responsible. He made a choice.
Correction, he files two separate claims against two parties, and that's where the case goes wrong a bit.
You could.
Because, you're really, when you're in the last injurious exposure rule, the other party is a necessary party, I think, could be argued.
Well, and you could say that all Mr. Giron needed to do in this case was potentially file the claim against RTAA because it was the last injurious exposure party. But again, at that point in time, RTAA wasn't a police officer as defined by 617-135. And that's that interpretation of that statute is what creates a lot of the problem in this case.
Yeah.
And I'll come back to that in just a minute. But what I want to get back to is the point that the process in workers' compensation is uniquely legislative, and this Court has recognized that in several cases, and in fact said the courts should not get involved in basically implying provisions that aren't expressly stated in the statute. That's the
Well, isn't the last injurious exposure rule essentially?
Yeah, that is a rule that's been adopted by the court. But my
so if we're on court-created territory, then wouldn't this be an appropriate?
Except that it inserts a procedure into the process that the legislature hasn't considered, hasn't seen appropriate to insert. And so basically the court's performing a legislative function if it does that.
But not if you make it a part of the last injurious exposure rule doctrine, that if the party wants to assert it, is going to assert it, the employer needs to ensure that the as a necessary party to that assertion, to the extent you're defeating the claimant's rights, that they include the other employer or employers.
I agree that you could look at it that way. I don't agree that it's not a legislative function.
Right.
I
mean,
this is such a uniquely statutory system that I think we get in trouble when we don't allow the legislature to sort through the processes.
And the last injurious exposure rule is judge-made, and you're arguing that our venturesome interpretation of the police officer statute is also judge-made, and that has created the procedural morass that we're in.
Yes.
That's not your words, mine.
Right. No, I understand. A particular one of the issues I see with inserting a joinder rule here that basically requires an employer to bring in another party is employers are not usually the party who is going to know who those employers are and who they've been. And they may know there's some additional employment after their own, but they're not situated to really know who the employers are. And again, the claimants
are. But if
they're
invoking last injurious exposure rule, wouldn't they have to be necessarily?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
They may know their subsequent employers. They may not know who they are. And what do you do in a situation where, for instance, if Mr. Giron had worked for Lyon County for an extended period of time and then went to California and worked for an entity in California doing police work over which Nevada has no jurisdiction? It's a problem.
So long as you're asserting that someone else is responsible for the compensation based upon last injurious exposure, that information would necessarily become a part of the proceeding, would it not?
I think eventually it would at some point, yes.
Okay.
And again, the... another reason why I think it's problematic, and Justice Sotomayor, you brought this up earlier, was there's no authority for creating a joinder rule like this. You haven't got case law that says it's appropriate. You've seen no statutory or no other jurisdiction that's done it statutorily or through the case law. There really isn't even any case law cited to you that it's an appropriate mechanism to insert at all, or that, you know, a court should insert some kind of procedural rule into a statutory scheme like the work comp system. So there are some real concerns here about creating this joinder rule, which leads me back to what RTAA believes is the real underlying problem in this case, and that is that the court has misinterpreted 617-135 and basically decided that RTAA police officers are encompassed within that definition when they haven't been listed in the definition. And if you look at the history of 617-135, in fact, the existence of that statute in and of itself creating a list suggests that the legislature does not intend or has not intended to make all peace officers police officers for the purposes of occupational disease under 617.
Well, what about the argument that this is not an exclusive list, that it's a list that includes these, and therefore it wouldn't be inappropriate to, in this instance, include them as a police officer?
And I think, Your Honor, you can look at it that way, certainly. But I think what the decision said initially was that the statute's ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we have to interpret what was intended under the statute. And it's our contention that what didn't happen in this case was an actual analysis of the legislative history of 617-135. Because if you do that, you see a very methodical approach by the legislature. They've never adopted a provision that says all peace officers in the state or anybody exercising the power of a police officer becomes a police officer under this definition. They've taken it one by one by one by one and never made an expansive definition. It's been amended 11 times over the years to add certain categories of police officers or specific police officers one by one by one. And that,
looking at the policy in doing that, there's a very specific policy with police officers and coronary issues. Why would you exclude a police officer or a public safety officer from that list when you included others that don't technically comply with that traditional definition?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. And the answer to that is because that's a legislative function. We have to let the legislature decide which particular police officers are the police officers that are entitled to that benefit. If you don't do that and you just say similarly situated people are covered, how do employers know which police officers are covered? How do they know when they need to, Mr. Ned said, do the annual exams so that they can preserve defenses or not?
No, please finish your thought.
The fact that the decision uses the term security officer creates a big problem, because does that mean now all private security officers are subject to this statute? I mean, what Mr. Giron was at the RTAA was an RTAA police officer. He wasn't a security guard. But the decision uses the term security guard. And so do employers out there now who employ private security guards, are they suddenly responsible under the heart-lung statute for heart disease?
So if we avoid creating a mandatory rule in our decision, and therefore becoming an outlier, apparently, across the nation, if we avoid getting in the way of legislative activities and simply do nothing more than vacate the panel decision in this case, doesn't that leave us right back at the hearings officer's decision? And therefore, Mr. Ground can proceed as he so chooses?
Well, I think if the result was what you indicated, what would happen is Mr. Giron would be entitled to benefits from Lyon County.
And Lyon County would be entitled to appeal that.
Well, if you send it all the way back to begin the administrative process, but I think if you just revisit the definition of 617-135 and decide that Mr. Giron was not a police officer under the definition, then at least...
I'm just saying we just vacate the whole thing and he starts over.
Well, I think that creates a problem because of 617-345.
And the definition.
The mandatory jurisdictional... issues.
But to finish your thought, if you hold that he's not a police officer in his employment for your client, then it would reinstate the benefits against Lyon County because the last injurious exposure rule argument would fail, and you would affirm what the agency did.
Well, what the district court did?
Yeah.
And what the...
Everybody else has ever looked at this.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Thank you again. I will address a couple points raised and then make some closing remarks. I think Justice Pickering had made a comment about two claims being filed. Technically, there was one claim that was amended. He initially filled out a claim form that identified RTA as the employer. He had a conversation, presumably with someone at RTA, and that person had indicated, well, wait a minute, we're not covered under the heart disease statute. And that's how he ended up changing it by calling his doctor's office to have Lyon County added to it. Presumably, the RTA's insurance company denied a claim because they were aware of the fact that he initially had identified them. So we really have one heart disease, and you really have one claim, trying to sort out the liability of it. Justice Sotomayor, you had expressed some concerns about a mandatory rule or setting up procedure. You already have a procedure here. The appeals officer, we can all agree, has the discretion to join somebody. And 616D050 gives her the authority to join somebody. The question is, really, for this panel, is whose responsibility is it? And clearly, it has to be the responsibility of the party raising it. I think Mr. Balkenberg said, or maybe it was Mr. Rowe, had indicated, well, how is the employer supposed to know? Justice Pickering, you made a point, well, if you're raising it, you must know somebody's out there. But again, I repeat, there are discovery avenues allowed in the workers' compensation statutory scheme. They could do depositions, request for production, and interrogatories. They could certainly find out if there are other employers. And if you go back to the Jess case, it ends with this court saying to Ms. Jess, identify who your husband worked for in the state of Nevada. In terms of a concern about whether, they might be working out of state, and will the appeals officer have jurisdiction? Well, the Jess case involves Nevada employers only. Nevada does not have jurisdiction in terms of licensure exposure for employers in California or New Mexico or anywhere else. There was an argument made in terms of not employing a procedure, this court not employing a procedure or creating a mandatory rule in terms of who's responsible because the legislator has not acted. Well, the last injurious exposure rule is not a legislative act itself. It's something that's made by this court and adopted by this court in 1985 in the Jess case. So it would be appropriate, as Justice Pickering was pointing out, for this court to set up the actual procedure. And again, it's really not a procedure. It's really about allocating responsibility. Whose job is it to bring somebody in here? And this last injurious exposure rule is not just an alternate defense theory. This is actually asking an appeals officer to say, okay, we all agree this is a compensable condition. Who should be responsible for it? And I go back to Nevada's minimum procedural due process requirements. You have to have that other party there. The appeals officer cannot say, I agree with you, Mr. Balkenbush. RTA officers are covered under the statute. Therefore, RTA is liable unless RTA is there. So it's very clear that if it's going to be raised, and you're going to have a party there for procedure due process reasons, it has to be the party raising the defense to bring those.
So you would urge the Justice Gibbons approach, the comparison to regular litigation as opposed to administrative proceedings and the necessary party process?
I think that's necessary, Justice Sotomayor, because this is a court-made rule, the last injurious exposure rule. I think that would be appropriate to set up that allocation of responsibility. Because like I say, the procedure's there. It's just a matter of whose job is it. I would point out the way it worked in this proceeding, Mr. Drone was asked to bring an RTA. And it's a little bit unusual, as Mr. Balkenbush, for this type of situation to arise where there was another claim. The ordinary course is to have an injured worker file another C-4 against employer. And as I pointed out in the petition for reconsideration, or en banc reconsideration, and not only does that violate the neutrality rule, where you have an injured worker who's now having to assist one of the employers in a defense, you actually have that person at risk because under 616D300, it's considered fraud if you make misrepresentations false misrepresentations to get some type of workers' compensation benefit. So to have a situation where an injured worker has to identify another injury with another employer when he himself is not making that charge exposes him in that way. So in terms of the big picture here, what we're asking this panel to do is to find that it was Lyon County's responsibility to bring in RTA, and the fact that they did not do that, they should be stuck with the responsibility for Mr. Jerome's claim because it was their inaction that led to the situation in the first place. I would point out, though, there is a basis, and I'm not here to make RTA's position, but there certainly is a position for this court to conclude RTA is not covered under the police officer statute. I don't want to repeat what I said earlier, but I'd like to expand upon that. You can see the deliberateness and preciseness of the legislative process when you look at other statutes involving police officers. There are two hepatitis statutes. There's 617485 and there's 617487. If you look at paragraph 7 of each of those statutes, they define police officers differently. One says, we're going to use the definition of a police officer under 617135, paragraph 1. The other statute says, well, we're going to use the definition of a police officer as it is in 617135, paragraphs 2 through 16. So this is a very deliberate process, and I think if the court goes back and looks at the question of ambiguity in terms of includes, it should be read to be an effort for limitation. In terms of looking at this matter overall, I took the time to look at everyone's biography on the website, and I'm assuming everyone here has some type of role in what's said about you on that website. And I noticed that everyone, either through a volunteer committee or belonging to a particular organization, or through your roles that you've taken as judges, whether it's a chief judge or in any other capacity as a judge, have participating in a process to improve the effectiveness and the efficiency of the litigation process itself. And this case really cries for that. You have a situation here where an appeals officer at the day of a hearing is asking another attorney, well, you're raising this defense, well, how do we get these people in here? And no one has a clear answer. And what we're asking is for this court to give that clear answer so that this could be an effective and efficient rule, this last injurious exposure rule. Mr. Jerome, his first hearing was September 23rd, 2011, and did proceed again to hearing in March 2012, all because of a lack of clarity as whose responsibility it is to bring in this other employer. And we would simply ask that if you produce that rule and say it is the responsibility of the proponent who is raising the last injurious exposure defense, that would not only make it to where Mr. Drone has a compensable claim, which is obviously our primary objective, but it also improves the process of the employment of the last injurious exposure rule.
I'm making an assumption I shouldn't make, but in your research dealing with this, did you find any other jurisdictions that had procedural rules that required that of either an answering party asserting that kind of defense or a hearing officer giving us a description of discretion of what they had to do?
But Justice Davis, I think it's difficult to do because we have a very unique...
The question is really simple. Did you look at other rules in other jurisdictions? Did you find anything?
I didn't find anything, and I'd just like to point out that our system is a little bit different. We don't have workers' compensation boards in the state of
Well, irrespective of the boards, there's going to be possibly something akin. These things don't come out of just the air. They kind of breed on each other a little bit and get modified for the jurisdictions.
So,
and that's
so,
why I'm asking the question.
So in those states where there are boards, do they have a procedure that they use?
I can't answer that question. But as I was saying, this is not an issue of how do we do it. The only question this court has is whose responsibility is it? The procedural mechanism is there. The precise procedural mechanism, meaning who's responsible for doing it, is what's missing. And that's what we're asking this court to fill in.
Anything else?
No, thank you for your
colleagues. Any other questions?
No.
All right. Thank you all very much. We appreciate your argument today. The matter will stand.